Hello and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Sharad Kutin.
Welcome to Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. Now, today, the Malaysian Hindu community celebrates Deepavali. And despite its religious, linguistic and cultural diversity, Hindus make up the majority of the Malaysian Indian community. So tonight on the show, we thought we'd to explore the challenges of the Malaysian Indian community as a whole, beginning with a look at the challenges of political representation. Joining us now is Ravan Kumar Krishnasamy. He is the new chief for MIC Youth. He's also the assembly person for Tenggaru in Johor. Ravan, thank you so much for joining us on the show tonight. Now, if I may begin with a look at some of the changing dynamics of, you know, both the political sphere as well as society in Malaysia. I mean, maybe you can begin by, you know, exploring how MIC might be responding to some of these changing dynamics.
Actually, you look at it, MIC has been a 60-year, more than 60 years, a party of history. I'm just part of it, for the past, I think I started my journey in MIC in 2006. So I'm already done in about 15, 16 years. So that's quite long, but I'm still in youth. So that shows my experience in MIC. But you look at it, the political scenario has changed, all right? If you look at it previously, when you, even I give you an example now currently in Melaka, all right? Usually we used house-to-house campaign. We used to have charama in big way, but now we can't do all that. Now it's totally changed. It's more digitalized. You need to meet the young generation in where they are. Where are they? They are in Instagram. They are in TikTok. They are in so many social medias. You can't do charama big way, and they are not attracted to all this big charama. They are preferred all the. So this is something that we are going to explore new in MIC, and MIC is working towards that. In going into more digitalization, engaging with youth and everything.
Ravan, it's very interesting. You mentioned the fact that that MIC, in fact, is a kind of a veteran. It's one of the political parties that was there at the founding of the nation. But yeah. The fate of MIC has always been tied to the coalition it was part of, first the Alliance and then Barisan Nasional. Very stable coalitions. But we're entering a phase of instability. The MIC had at some point to choose between Perikatan Nasional and Barisan Nasional. And there's a real tug of war on the question of the identity of the government. The Perikatan Nasional government started off by claiming it was a Malay Muslim government, very unlike the previous coalitions. So where does MIC stand in this changing landscape? What exactly is its message to its core constituents?
You see, actually, MIC, we've been always standing together with Barisan Nasional, all right? We have established a very good relationship, working relationship with them. We have a very good understanding with Barisan Nasional. So with the new political scenario after post-election, after 2018, there's a lot of political instability. There was two changes of government took place. There was adaptation for the benefit of the people, you know, that we need to stabilize the government, because with the pandemic we needed to stabilize the government. So that we went into working relationship with Perikatan, but together with Barisan Nasional. That was the understanding there, so that we can stabilize the government, because during pandemic it's not good to have a very unstable government. The people depended on the government to make the right decision at the right time. So this was one of the decisions.
The MIC has suffered electoral defeats over the last electoral cycles, resulting in very few representatives in either parliament or state assemblies. This shrinking base, as it were, in terms of representation, is it because Pakatan Harapan has been very successful in grabbing the multi-ethnic middle ground that in some ways the MIC kind of depended? MIC, the Indian community has no majority constituencies, so MIC has always relied on a multi-ethnic voter base in order to get representation.
Okay, if you look at it, if you look at the whole country, there's not many, I don't think there's only one seat where we have majority of Indian voters, which is Buntong, which is about 51%. The other seats throughout Malaysia, we are only minority in the constitution. So eventually we had to stand, we had to contest in a seat where we are the minority. But if you look at it, the scenario from 2008, I think that's when, you know, you look at the numbers was dropping for MIC. Before that, we had a clean sweep in all our 18 parliament, don't sit and 9 parliamentary seat. This, I will say, is not, it's not about the people losing confidence in MIC, but it was moving because I would say like how the campaign we were doing last time, we were going on local crowd, we were going on house to house, we were going on a broader basis, but people were going into more digitalization. It's where it started, digitalization, and maybe we were late in picking that up, and then we lose out on the voters, and currently we are picking it up. And it also depends. You see, when you come into MIC, right, we always go to the ground, help the people. And these people will be more on B40. I think maybe we didn't touch the middle class or the upper income group because maybe they didn't need so much of help. So they eventually, MIC and them, the ground difference. You know, there was a difference of, not difference of opinion, but they were separated in a way, lah, we did not communicate with them. This is my point of view. We did not have the communication with them because we were only focusing on the B40, helping the B40, helping the needy. And then we departed. That was a fault in 2018, then 2008 onwards. Then we had to set back a change. And, you know, we started back, you know, but we had to catch up. That's what I'm trying to say.
Okay. Well, you're the new MIC youth chief. You newly won that position. Can I ask you about that, you know, the youth vote that everyone, all the political parties will likely be trying to court? I'm just wondering what your thinking is, particularly within the party, about the types of conversations that young Indians in Malaysia are having, the challenges that they are facing that are particular to them, particularly as we see, you know, new parties like MUDA coming up, claiming to represent the youth voice. Is MIC Youth doing anything different to court the youth vote, particularly with the challenges of today?
Actually, we are. We look at it. Before me was Tin Alan. We started with Tin Alan. We are engaging more with the youth now. And if you look at it, the party has been led by Tan Sri Vigneswaran, and he was also a national youth leader before. So he actually has the idea of the youth, how the youth should move. We are starting our own brigade. We are on the verge of starting the brigade, which was started by him in when he was the youth leader, and we managed to gather a crowd of about 20,000 in Stadium Merdeka during that time. And we are now engaging back with the youth. We are also looking for more on professionals coming with us. And we are getting a lot of professionals. Even when since I took over becoming the youth leader, I've been approached by a lot of young professionals showing the intention to join the party. They want to have a talk with me. They want to just know what the idea of the party is going on. Where are we going? Because they also want to see what is the direction. You see, in this country, for the past 60, 70 years, MIC been one of the most established Indian party in this country. That's without a doubt, it's been most established Indian party. And we are working towards having a better, stronger relationship with them so that they can join and they know how the we have outlined our movement. And if I will ask me, I got a few tasks ahead to see for the Indian youth. First of all, for youth, they is not only serious matter. They also want to help people, but in a jovial manner. You know, they must be interested. It should not just be totally politics, politics, and politics. It should be giving them all the freedom to move. You cannot have the old style. The younger generation must follow a certain rule. They cannot be, they are beyond rule. So you have to guide them on that, you know, to make it interesting.
Okay, all right. Thank you so much, Ravin, for joining us on the show. We appreciate your time and you sharing your insights. Ravin Kumar Krishnasamy, Chief of MIC Youth there. And we're going to take a quick break here and consider this, but we will be back with more. Stay tuned. Hi, thanks so much for staying with Shraddha and I on Consider This. The Malaysian Indian Blueprint was launched in 2017. That was under the Najib Razak administration's 11th Malaysia Plan. And it was touted to be the official 10-year government blueprint for the development of the Indian community in Malaysia. The blueprint, together with its implementation unit, SEDIC, or Socioeconomic Development of the Indian Community Unit, was later renamed and reorganized as the Malaysian Indian Transformation Unit, or better known as MITRA. This was under the Pakatan Harapan former Minister P. Wethamurthy. Now, joining us on the show tonight to discuss the progress and the commitment to the blueprint, we have Professor Datuk Dr. Denison Jayasuriya. He's Principal Research Fellow at the Institute of Ethnic Studies at University Kebangsaan Malaysia. Denison, let's begin our conversation tonight with perhaps you helping us understand the rationale behind the Malaysian Indian Blueprint and whether there's still a commitment towards it.
Yeah, I would say there is a commitment because it is reflected in the 12th Malaysia Plan that one of the steps under the B40 section of the 12th Malaysia Plan, which includes other sections on the Bumiputra community, the Orang Asli community, as well as on poverty and vulnerable groups, the Malaysian Indian Blueprint is indicated that it would be enhanced in the period of the 12th Malaysia Plan. It's just one line. So one would have to see over the next 4 years how that works out in practical working out. But that same paragraph in the 12th Malaysia Plan then notes 10 specific interventions, which then looks at poverty or education or economic issues on youth. This is just highlighted in one-line sentences, which then has to be translated through budget and through line ministries, not just MITRA, but other ministries, for example, if it is education-related, if it is health-related, if it is entrepreneurship related, then by the different ministries. So we can only go by what the 12th Malaysia Plan states, and that has to be monitoring and discussions to see how it is implemented over the next 4 years, 2022 to 2025.
Denison, what marks this blueprint, off from previous efforts to deal with problems that are specific to the Indian community and more specifically, its working class? So, is there anything in it that suggested a new frame of thinking, new ideas about the major stakeholders in this process, or mechanisms or structures to say distribute resources and such? Was there any new thinking, or was it pretty much the reiteration of what had happened before?
Okay, I think one could say this is the only official government sponsored document. All previous documents, if we go back to research done on the plantations or squatters and displaced Indians and so forth, are all the work of academics or civil society or political parties. So the blueprint was an effort after 2008, the Najib administration set up for the first time a cabinet committee on the Indian community to access services or to be mainstreamed into the development agenda. So in many ways, the issues that the blueprint highlight in terms of its analysis and implementation is similar to many of the research on urban poverty, on marginalization, but it's now coming as an official document through the Economic Planning Unit with the foreword of the Prime Minister. So that is really significant, and the Cabinet Committee is significant. And during that time, many of us, academics and so forth, were involved in the preparation or input. I can note like Professor Mahindran of Sunway wrote many sections of it. Much of the work that we did at the Institute of Ethnic Studies is also referred to, and many others. Never before has there been data on crime, on domestic violence, on education, on economic. So it's a sort of a government-endorsed document in itself. How was it executed over the period of time, post-2018 PH? Of course, PH had criticisms on it. They felt it was politicized, and there was a downplaying of the blueprint. But I think the current government at Putrajaya, through the 12th plan, is relooking, and we are told that a USM team is updating the data, because you have household income survey 2019, poverty line has shifted, various other economic and labor data from DOSM is new. So I would say it's not rocket science. Problems of urban poverty, marginalization, displacement is there. But for government to issue a document, it's the first time.
Right. And I hear you that we are not short of great talent in helping create blueprints, in having data-driven recommendations, but the flaw or often the failure is in the execution, right? And I want to talk about the implementation execution of this blueprint, particularly in the fact that the government has shown its commitment by giving Mitra funding allocation of 100 million ringgit, an annual funding allocation of 100 million ringgit. I think in budget 2022, it was increased to 145 million ringgit. So the question is whether the funding is going to the right causes to help with the progress of development within the Indian community, particularly those who need it the most.
Okay. Melissa, 100 million is a lot of money. I would agree. And it has been systematically allocated. There is very little public document to show where the money went, who took it, transparent documents, I would say that. Having said that, you need to compare in the 12th plan or even in the budget allocations for other sections of Malaysian society, which would be very disproportionate. So in one sense, ethnicizing the budget and focusing just on ethnic communities is good and bad, and we can discuss that. But I would agree with you, the delivery has been a major issue. Now, prior to the setting up of SEDIC, with 2008 right down to about 2015, the earlier parts of the 10th Malaysia plan, there were various working committees that the government sponsored. There was the Special Implementation Task Force, there was the Tamil School Recovery Program, there was SEED, which was an economic empowerment program, and there was SEDIC that was granting grants. That time, it was Professor N.S. Rajendran taking the lead from UPSI. He was seconded for that purposes. But subsequently, we are seeing constantly this complaint from different sections of the community that these funds or programs are being politicized, because parties in government close to that ethnic community, whether it was BN or PH, tended to favor people and groups. So many others have called for more transparent, independent, more accountable institutions that are more professional. So if you take the 12th Malaysia plan, for the Bumiputra community, many institutions have been set up. whether it is Mara, whether it's Traju, whether there are dedicated yayasans to attend certain things, they have tended to be headed by professionals or community people, and they seem to be operating more independently in that context. Mitra now comes under the Ministry of National Unity, which in itself is quite ambiguous because the ministry is not to promote any ethnicized approach. So many would say it should return back to the Prime Minister's department. I think Dr. Mahathir at that time reduced the size of the Prime Minister's department. So in many ways, when YB Vedamurthy was in charge in the Prime Minister's department, he also had the Orang Asli community, he had the Indian Mitra, and he had a national unity. So it looked more balanced to vulnerable sections of the society.
Dennis, if I can interrupt you, because I think there's always this nagging suspicion, perhaps unfairly at times, that you know these schemes are set up essentially to give jobs to the politically connected and to create opportunities for leakages. Because we see very recently the arrest of company directors, and it seems to be associated with Mitra. Again, I mean, aren't there a lot of moral hazards, it seems, in setting up these schemes where politicians manipulate the brand, as it were, you know, helping the community and so on and so forth, but actually just helping themselves to the kitty?
I think in the recent arrest, the directors, to clarify, I don't think were, because Mitra has no directors, I don't think civil servants were arrested. There were people who have received grants from Mitra, and how they utilized or secured those grants is in question. And also, Kutan, no one has been charged yet. So it will be difficult to conclude till you see the charge sheets and the details coming out from MACC. I would agree with you that in contrast, the Bhumiputra schemes seem to be headed independent and run. They are not government agencies like Mara or Tekun or even Amana Iktia. They are being run by professionals appointed by government with representatives from government in the boards and so forth. So I would say a more transparent declaration of application and who gets the funds, the criteria. Some of us have said that Mitra should use the guidelines set by Yayasan Hazana. Yayasan Hazana, in its grant giving, and now in the 2022 budget, is allocated 100 million with GLCs to work on community empowerment, CSO, very similar. But Yayasan Hazana has developed a very good due diligence scheme of reviewing applications. It starts with smaller grants, and then you prove yourself and then build on. I think Mitra, from what I hear, because I'm not privy to any internal documents, I looked at their search for their website before this conversation. The website is removed for the moment, so I don't know whether somebody hacked into it or what. But, you know, the whole question is not so much of ethnicity or politics. It's about the governance structure. And if in the Indian community now, if out of the 16 members of parliament, majority are on the opposition, it's best to have a more multi-party or more professional-based, neutral from politics, who actually run it. And I would agree with you, both of you, that it should be targeting to the original intention of the blueprint, to disadvantaged poor communities on the ground. And there are enough structures, policies, mechanisms to do that. It's unfortunate this has come up, but it doesn't mean it's the end, because 2022, they have allocated, as what Melissa said, 145 million. I know for a fact now that the persons heading it are PTD officers. PTD officers are officers who would run any of the civil service at the high level. So the person is a PTD. Professor N.S. Rajendran used to be at JUSA B, but now it is at S54, which is quite a senior position in government.
Okay. Dennison, I'm so sorry to have to interrupt you, but we have run out of time. And I just want to thank you so much for sharing your insights with us, Professor Dennison Dasura from the Institute of Ethnic Studies at UKM. And that is all we have for you on this episode of Consider This. On behalf of the Consider This team, happy Deepavali to everyone who is celebrating. And thank you so much for watching the show tonight. I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Sharad Kutan, signing off for the evening.
We will be back with you same time tomorrow. Till then, good night.
Night.